Hello there. Servus. My name is Haishan Wade, and you're listening to This Week in Geopolitics, where we take a look at the events of yesterday and detail how they paint the geopolitical reality of today. Now, what do I got for you today? Well, today we have a little bit about the Russo-Ukrainian War, some of the developments there, and what I think it might mean coming up. Then we have this article from the Daily Caller talking about conflict in East Asia with China and North Korea. And then we'll go over something that's been on my mind for a while, which is some of the missed opportunities we've had that we could have taken even just in the space that this war has gone on. All that and more coming up. Alrighty, let's get into the rapid-fire news. So, right off the bat, we have the city of Soledar falling. This is a small town close to Bakhmut, I believe to the north of the city. And with the fall of Soledar, and this is primarily the Russians saying that they've captured the city, from my understanding, there is still a little bit of fighting going on in the city, but the majority of the town has been taken by the Russians, so it's accurate enough to say that they've taken the city as the Ukrainians are being forced to withdraw as we speak. So Soledar has fallen, and now Bakhmut has come in, it's come even closer being encircled. But the strange thing, and I guess it really shouldn't be strange, because we've witnessed this happening over the course of the war, is that the Ukrainian government, the Ukrainian military, continues to feed more troops into Bakhmut rather than pulling out. Like, for a while, it was looking like they were pulling troops out of Bakhmut. Now it looks like they're trying to reinforce Bakhmut. So perhaps there's some sort of conflict going on at the higher levels where they're not entirely sure what they want to do, or at a bare minimum, there's a disagreement between maybe Zelensky and Zaluzhny, or between Zaluzhny and Zelensky and other forces within the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian military. Because it seems like there isn't a clear idea of what they want to achieve here. Maybe it's PR, but I don't see how doubling down on this city is going to be good for PR. If it falls, like, and I said this much back when Zelensky gave his speech to Congress, he centered his speech around Bakhmut, and I said it on the podcast, that was like the worst place you could have possibly picked to be the centerpiece of your speech, because Bakhmut is going to fall. It is now coming dangerously close to being encircled. Dangerously close. It, at a bare minimum, it's in a cauldron now, which means that the Russians are just going to continue hammering away at them with artillery. Except now they can do it from three sides rather than just one side, and you have a consolidated line covering your flanks. No, your flanks are exposed because the Russians have you on three sides. This city is going to fall, and that was evident back for like weeks prior to him giving that speech in Congress. If anything, that was the height of whatever PRW you could have gotten out of this victory. If PR is the real reason behind this, I don't know what the real reason is. There's been lots of PR stunts that the Ukrainians have done, so I can't rule PR out as a possibility to gen up support in the West to give Ukraine more aid or justify the giving of Ukraine more aid, because the support is declining, but it's the politicians who want to keep going. So give the justification rather than actually ginning up support, because that support is evaporated, even amongst the Europeans. It's the governments who are all in on this. But even from a PR perspective, they cashed out already. That speech in Washington, that joint press briefing he had with Biden, That was it. That was as much PR and as much support as you were going to be able to garner out of this city and fighting and holding on to this location. So I'm not entirely sure if PR can explain away why they're doing what they're doing right now. Perhaps it's strategic in that Bakhmut really is the central hub of logistics and the defensive line in the Donbass. And if they lose it, they'll be forced out of the Donbass altogether. Maybe that's the case. I'm more inclined to believe that now than I was a few months ago. I was skeptical at first, but I'm really getting around to believing that. But to bet the entire war at this point on this one city, I don't see the gain in doing that. Especially now when we're seeing these casualty numbers and these dead, not casualties, dead figures. That alongside with the casualty figure. Because I was hearing numbers back over the summer, back when I first started listening to Scott Ritter and Douglas McGregor, who have the two combined have just been immeasurable in the value I've gotten out of them with regards to covering this war. But they were talking about, and primarily Scott Ritter, 8-1 advantage in artillery, 8-1 KD ratio in Russia's favor, where they're killing 8 Ukrainians for 1 Russian. And then when we get to now, where we're looking at the Russians being anywhere from 15,000 to 30,000 dead, and the Ukraine, well, casualties, I should say, not dead. So 15,000 to 30,000 casualties versus 160,000 casualties that we know of now on the Ukrainian side. Because they had 350,000 troops at the beginning of this, combat operational troops. They're down to 190, and that was before, that was at least a week before Zelensky gave his speech to Congress, because Zaluzhny brought up that number when he was giving his interview to The Economist. That is a difference of 160,000 men. And you had Ursula von der Leyen, just a few weeks before Zaluzhny gave that interview. She brought out a figure of 100, of over 100. She didn't say exactly the number, but she said over 100,000 dead. Not casualties, dead. So you're talking about a two-thirds death to wounded, a two-thirds dead to wounded ratio among your casualties. On top of an actual 8-1 lopsided advantage in casualties for the Russians. The Russians can now verifiably, we can confirm that they have verifiably inflicted an 8-1 casualty ratio on the Ukrainians. So, the strategic aspect of this, I don't see it. How are you going to bet the war on this one city when you're taking casualties like that? Because the fighting in the Donbass has gone on for a while. The Battle of Bakhmut itself has gone on since at least, like, August. Like, well, I started hearing about Bakhmut back in August. Some say it started even earlier than that with the Wagner troops. The Russian contract, well, mercenary soldiers, however you want to put it, they got there first, and then they tried to go in, and they began the attack on Bakhmut, and it was only after the Russians had annexed the four regions and started integrating the militias from the Donbass under a unified command with their General Suravikin, who's currently the one in charge. He wasn't in charge before, he's in charge now. And he's probably going to be the one overseeing the offensive operations whenever those kick off. But we've been hearing about Bakhmut for months now, and the pressure on it has only ever continued to grow. And they're taking these horrendous casualties. Like, 8-1, no matter how you want to put it, that's bad. That's terrible. How do you justify that in one city in the Donbass? Maybe it's a bargaining chip. And this just comes to my mind now, because if they have control of at least some of the Donbass, they can at least not concede or be forced into a position where they would have to concede the Donbass, all of it. Because if they're forced out the Donbass, now Russia has the upper hand in any potential peace talks, where they can say, look, you've lost the Donbass, We're not giving you back those other territories, Zaporizhia and Kherson, that we took. Those are ours. Now, would you want a peace? If they continue, if Ukraine continues occupying territory in the Donbass, then they don't have to suffer that humiliation. But even that can't fully explain this, because a humiliation over your army, that doesn't make sense, especially when you look at Zaluzhny, who spent the whole summer trying to build up the reserves, the trained reserves of people who could go in and begin fighting it on the turn of a dime, like that. He spent the whole summer building up these reserves, and then they got blown away when they did the Kherson offensive. So, for him to have spent that much time and that much effort and all those resources building up these reserves, it doesn't make sense for them to be throwing away men now on one city that's, quite frankly, not going to win them the war. Bakhmut did not need to be the decisive battle of the war. It's looking like it's going to be, unless something even bigger pops up later on. But had the Ukrainians withdrew earlier, it wouldn't have that prospect for it. It would not have the prospect of becoming the most consequential battle in the war that we know of to date. But because of how many men have been lost here, because of how much blood, sweat, and tears have been poured into defending this position, in vain, increasingly in vain, it's about to be encircled. It is about to be encircled. Bakhmut did not need to be the decisive battle of the war. And it was, as far as I can understand, it was not intended to be the decisive battle of the war, even on the part of the Ukrainians. But because of how much they have, in my opinion, overcommitted to this city, it looks like, when it falls, they're going to have this really, really big hole in their lines. And this depends on how they manage things from this point onwards, because with the fall of Soledar, the prospect of a Bakhmut encirclement is coming into view. There was talk about it. There was Russia capturing a certain number of villages to the south. But now with them making moves in the north, it looks like they are capable of a double pincer move, where they can cut Bakhmut off from the west, which would complete the encirclement. And if the Russians are able to hold that line, then everyone in that city either dies or surrenders. And there are thousands of Ukrainian soldiers there. Thousands of men that Ukraine cannot afford to lose at this point in time. They've lost too much as is against the force that the Russians have available to them right now, which is probably closer to about 200,000, 250,000 with that mobilization they did with the 300,000 troops. A lot of those have started trickling in. I'm getting numbers of about 80 to 100,000. So, we're looking at the Russians already having a numerical advantage on the battlefield over the entirety of the Ukrainian army. Ukraine cannot afford to lose a 1,000 men, 10,000, 5,000, whatever the number in Bakhmut is, we'll find out eventually. They can't afford to lose that right now. They need everybody they have. But if they lose that, they're going to have this gap in their lines. They're going to have to stretch the troops that they have in other positions to fill that line, which will only make the entire line weaker. I spoke a couple weeks ago about what I believed would be their next plausible defensive line along the Kalinivka River, running from the cities of Kramatorsk, Druskivka, and Kostantinivka. But how would they even man a line like that if they don't have the troops? Or if they're scrambling to fill a hole, a gap left by the destruction of an entire Ukrainian army? And by army, I don't mean their entire armed forces. I mean like an operational unit. I'll just say a handful of divisions. They can't defend that. And once the Russians have a hole like that opened up, there's no telling what they will allow themselves to do. Will they continue to go slow and just press Ukraine on all fronts? Or will they try to exploit the breakthrough? Because if they exploit the breakthrough, now Ukraine is in dire straits. Because now they have to rapidly maneuver troops to deal with the maneuvering troops. Instead of moving troops around from their entrenched positions out into the open, where they're exposed to fire, as they're trying to get to new positions to cover the hole in the line, if the Russians break through a gap, now the Russians have, not the Russians, now the Ukrainians have to defend against the push, which means that they have to extend their lines even more, or they have to go for a counter-encirclement. Good luck with that, when the Russians are hammering you with artillery. Because the second the Ukrainians come out of their defenses, they get hammered by artillery. It just doesn't make sense to me for them to double down on this one place. Especially when you have that Kalinivka line. Now, maybe it's not as effective of a defensive position as I'm making it out to be. I'm not the military guy here. But the Kalinivka River and that string of urban defenses that they could use is not far away. It's not that much of a withdrawal to get to a position like that. And if the Russians are going to go slow anyway, well, you may as well consolidate your lines behind a new defensive position. Bakhmut may have been great in the past, in the beginning of the war, or during the summer, but it's not going to last them much longer. Certainly, they should be able to see that. So, I can't wrap my mind around why they would want to die on this hill. Literally. Literally, for a good number of them, they're going to die on this hill. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out when all is said and done. But as of right now, it's a blunder. It's looking increasingly like a blunder, and that blunder might cost them the entire war before the Russians began their offensive. And that would be the real killer. If they lose the war before the Russians kicked it into high gear. Because if you lose that many men, and you're already outnumbered on the battlefield, and the Russians decide that they're just going to start advancing on you, and they start taking little nips and bites at your front lines and getting small encirclements here, small encirclements there, and just start chewing away at the force you have left in a series of small offensives, they can't defend against that because Ukraine's lines would be too extended. They would be, well, a sitting duck. They'd be asking for that kind of a bits and pieces type offensive. And then they'd be crushed when the big offensive comes in. And they know that the big offensive is coming. Now, whether or not they believe they can defend against that is a completely different subject altogether that I couldn't answer for you. I can tell you what my opinion on the matter is, which is that they can't. But given the situation on the field currently, even without those hundreds of thousands of Russian troops waiting to just dog this country, it doesn't make sense for them to go all in on Bakhmut, even now, especially now, when it looks like it's about to be encircled. But we'll see what happens, and we'll see if Bakhmut gets encircled before they pull the troops out, or after they pull the troops out. Because one way or the other, Bakhmut will fall. It's just a matter of how the Ukrainians will manage that defeat. And that'll be interesting to watch. Enough about Ukraine for the time being. I still have to get to the rest of the rapid fire. We have China restarting its high-speed rail transportation with Hong Kong as a part of their larger reopening. We have a major missile strike hitting apartments in Kherson, killing at least 30 people and injuring more than 70. The missiles, and there was another missile attack in Dnipro as well. These missiles are presumed to be Russian, at least for the time being. We'll see if they end up being Ukrainian later on. We'll just have to wait and see. I am happy I didn't jump the gun on Poland. So, we'll see. We'll see. We have the U.S. and U.S. and Italian oil companies have discovered new gas deposits in the Egyptian Eastern Mediterranean offshore. So the water that's under Egypt's territory and their exclusive economic zone, they've discovered a patch of gas there. So, the Eastern Mediterranean is looking like it's about to start heating up again. Now, that's a flashpoint that kind of comes on and off. Kind of comes on and on. I said on and on. On and off. But I think it's about to start heating up there again. And with NATO in the state that it's in right now, where they've emptied out their arsenals, I'm not entirely sure how many of those countries would be able to stand up to Turkey. Because Turkey hasn't emptied out its arsenals. They, oh boy, no. They haven't emptied out their arsenals to the Ukrainians. That's everyone else. Now, I don't believe the Greeks have gone all in on Ukraine either, but a conflict in the Eastern Mediterranean might become something that pops up on the horizon as these gas deposits in the Eastern Mediterranean start to get more attention and more notice. Turkey is now a gas hub for Russian gas, but what if they have their own gas that they want to export? Now they can start thinking about the prospect of running their own pipelines parallel to the Russian pipelines. Now Turkey gets two birds with one stone. They can be a gas hub for Russia and a gas hub for themselves, and whatever projects the Russians pursue, they'll just run their own pipelines along. But in order to do that, they need the natural gas. They have to get that from the Eastern Mediterranean, which means you're going to have a series of disputes, maybe wars, but disputes at the bare minimum, over who gets the gas. Because sea territory has been oddly contentious in my short time learning about the various sea boundary lines, especially within the Eastern Mediterranean and in the South China Sea. Oh, the South China Sea is that's a mess. If you ever want a good reason as to why America shouldn't be there, look at China's claims. Everyone knows China's nine dash line, where they claim basically the entire thing. But check out when you have the chance. Look at Vietnam's claims to the South China Sea. You'll be astonished. You'll be astonished. But those overlapping claims, and it should be easy because technically the UN Law of the Sea states you get 12 miles. So that should be the case if they're all abiding by international law. But no one wants to abide by international law when it goes contrary to their own national interests. They want as much as they can get out of the system. Vietnam wants they want the whole South China Sea. They want more territory than China. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but it's almost the same. Like, it shocked me when I saw it. No one talked about Vietnam's claims. But there's so many overlapping claims that it's like, why would we ever want to get involved in that? And the same thing is, I feel, is going to end up being true in the Eastern Mediterranean. And there's at least as many countries involved in the Eastern Mediterranean that live there, let alone the countries that don't live there that are going to get involved anyway. Turkey, Greece, Libya, the part of Libya that Turkey backs, you know, not General Haftar, the Libyan government. You have Egypt, you have Israel, technically Palestine, but you know, Palestine is occupied at the moment, and I use that with two meanings. There's Lebanon. Lebanon's not a player right now, but they could be if they wanted to. There's a lot of players here. There's Italy, there's France, there's the United States when the United States wants to be. There's a whole lot of players here. There's also Crete. Not Crete. Goodness, I'm all over the place. Cyprus. And there's also Cyprus. Lots of overlapping claims here. So once one power starts to dig into these gas resources, I feel it's going to kickstart a wave of contestation, where everyone's going to be contesting the claims of everyone else because everyone wants the gas. Which means that o only he who has the force to take said gas will get said gas. And Turkey has been building the force to take said gas. And we will see how others respond. Last time it was the French who stopped them. We'll see if France is in a position to do that again. Maybe they need to team up with Greece. We'll see if those two together are able to do that again. Or if they're not. Now, that would be an upset. If Turkey beats Greece and France in a war at sea, that would be a humiliation. And would really mark the end of an era. If the Russo-Ukrainian war and its end didn't do that already, a war between NATO states would definitely, definitely usher in a brand new era that we'd have to reconcile with. That's the Eastern Mediterranean. You have the Pentagon giving $180 million to Ukraine. Ha! They may as well have, but they gave it to Taiwan. You have the United Arab Emirates, their president, Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, and the South Korean president, Yoon Suk Yeol. They met in Abu Dhabi, and they talked. So they're establishing relations. Probably energy-related relations, if we're being completely honest. But we'll see what comes out of that eventually. You have the Brazilian Supreme Court deciding to prosecute Bolsonaro over the Capitol riot. And it's really looking like this whole January 8th Capitol riot in Brazil is going to go down the exact same path as the January 6th riot in the United States. Which leads me to question whether the thing was staged like January 6th was. Where it was instigated by a handful of government operatives to get the people to go onto all these buildings and onto these government land, which is usually under surveillance and under lock and key and being actively protected by guards, but somehow conveniently was unguarded on the day that the mob showed up. So it's looking like it's going down the January 6th path. We'll see if this was a legitimate riot and attempt at overthrow, or if it was, like January 6th, a rather benign event that's used by the government to crack down on opposition. And January 6th is still being used by the Democrats to crack down on opposition, particularly among the Republicans. And what we'll see what comes out of that investigation that they say that they want to do, the Republicans, that is. And we'll see what comes out of this, the Brazilian Supreme Court prosecuting Bolsonaro. Now, Bolsonaro is in America, so it's, they can't do much to him unless we extradite Bolsonaro to them, which I'm not entirely sure that we would do, but it could happen. But who knows? Well, we'll definitely have to wait and see on this one. We shall see. Sweden has discovered a major deposit of rare earth in northern Sweden, which is the largest deposit in Europe. So it looks like Europe is, or at the very least Sweden, is now going to try to get into the rare earth game. Now, if only we could do that with our rare earth here in the United States. One day. We have China reaching nearly $1 trillion in their trade surplus for 2022. And mind you, this was with their zero COVID lockdowns in Shanghai and a number of their other cities. Now, I said nearly $1 trillion. It was, to be specific, it was $877 billion. So once they fully reopen, which they're getting close to, it's highly likely that they're going to surpass $1 trillion in their trade surplus for this year. Highly likely. They're looking at a boom. Definitely a boom. A V-shaped recovery, as Trump would say. I want him back. But anyway, there's a natural gas pipeline that was running from Latvia to Lithuania. It has suddenly exploded, cutting off Lithuania from Latvian gas. America did it, and so anyway, it's obvious. It's obvious. Like, who else would do it? Who else would do it but us? Russia? No. They have their own pipeline. They're building more pipelines. They don't need this. And isn't it convenient that just 6 months after the Nord Stream pipelines get bombed, all of a sudden these pipelines in Latvia and Lithuania just magically blow up in the dead of winter. In the dead of winter. And they were working perfectly fine for decades prior. I don't know how long the pipeline's been there, so I'll just say years. It's been working perfectly fine for years. And now all of a sudden it blows up, just 6 months after the Nord Stream pipelines get sabotaged? Okay, whatever you say, America did it. But that's all I got for you for the rapid fire news, and we'll get into the meat of this episode in just a moment. And we're back, and we're going to talk about setting the theater in East Asia, and we'll get into what that means and when we go over who said it. But while I was gathering up the news for this week's episode, I came across an article from the Daily Caller. Coincidentally, I had actually listened to a Jackson Hinkle segment where he was talking about this same exact article earlier on in this week. And so, having the chance to read it myself, I did not like what I read, but I figured it was important, so I'm reading it to you to talk about. But anyways, the article was about how the U.S. is increasing its military presence in East Asia in response to provocations from China and North Korea. So, at this point in the game, when we're looking at a potential war over Taiwan, and by potential, I may as well say inevitable, because no one on our side wants to walk away from the conflict. No one on our side wants to say no to the war, which we could, and sidestep this entire problem. No one wants to do that, so I may as well say inevitable, but it doesn't have to be, you know? But this article from the propaganda press trying to drum up support for a war with China, at this point in the game, after all the other articles trying to do the same and all the other mini documentaries, where those like 20 to 30 minute long documentaries that pop up on YouTube every now and then from various news channels, namely DW, trying to drum up support from war, or either that or Sky News Australia, at this point in the game, I expect the anti-China angle. I expect to be inundated with propaganda that tells me that I need to go to war with China because something, 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 national security, something, 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 regional stability, and maybe allies, maybe democracy, and maybe something about U.S. interests. I expect that much at this point, which is how I can sidestep it so easily. But the China part wasn't what was shocking. Because, again, I expect it. They manufacture consent for this all the time. But what got me was that there was so much emphasis on North Korea. If you had read just that article, if you were completely oblivious to the geopolitical scene, everything going on, Ukraine, Taiwan, if you were a complete and total newbie, like you went into a coma in 2000, and then you woke up now, and this was the first thing you read, you would think that North Korea was the up-and-coming superpower, and that China was some secondary issue. That, like, it was shocking to me, the way that they really, really tried to play up the North Korea side of this, and how North Korea could go into South Korea. So I guess they're trying to bring North Korea back into the picture, in case anyone forgot, because a whole lot of people forgot. I have to go out of my way to mention to mention South Korea when I talk about places I don't want us to defend. Because the border between them has been rather quiet, relatively, you know. They've started ramping up their missile tests ever since Biden came along. But it wasn't that long ago, just 2019, 4 years ago, almost to the day, and in just a few months. Just in 2019. Donald Trump walked across the DMZ, shook hands with that man, Kim Jong-un, and then they walked back together across the DMZ, the leader of North Korea in South Korea, and then they walked back. They shook hands again, and then Trump came back across the border. Trump crossed the border 4 times that day. Maybe the North Koreans needed to build a wall. But he crossed the border 4 times. Kim Jong-un crossed the border 2x. He came on this side, on South Korea, South Korean grounds, and then walked back. No one got shot. No one got assassinated. No one stepped on a landmine. It was not that long ago that we had peace coming into view. If not between North and South Korea, then surely between North Korea and the United States. And as far as I'm concerned, that's all that matters. But that opened the door for North and South Korea to have a whole detente. I mean, I remember North and South Korea teaming up at the Olympics. I forget which Olympics it was, but they had merged their teams, and they represented Korea, not North Korea, not South, but Korea at the Olympics. And I speculated for a good while. I think Korean unification was on the horizon. Now, perhaps it still is, and it's just being obscured by this momentary rise in tensions. But it's mind-boggling to think that just 4 years ago, that was the situation. Versus now, and 4 years ago, no one was even talking about a North Korean threat. It had been so thoroughly diffused compared to where it was under Obama and basically every other administration. But it wasn't that long ago that that territory, that area, that flashpoint just fell off our radar. No one spoke about the threat of North Korea attacking South Korea. It was all about China, Taiwan. It was all about Russia and Ukraine. And every now and then you'd get Israel and Iran. North Korea was forgotten and not worried about. And they were, quite frankly, happy. They were happy. They were a happy people at that time to not be constantly pressed on by the United States and our constant drills with South Korea and our provocations. No one talks about our provocations, even though we're the one who crosses the ocean to go over and be over there. But there was a time when we were staring at the prospect, a real prospect of peace on the Korean Peninsula. But now, here we are, 4 years later, that prospect has been temporarily neutered. I won't say it's been permanently neutered, but I won't say it's been killed either. But it's been put down for the time being. And we're talking about conflict. We're talking about conflict in the East Asia region. And now we're trying to remind people that North Korea was a problem. Well, they're testing missiles. Oh, they're doing this. Oh, they're doing that. When literally no one thought about North Korea anymore. When they talked about threats to the United States, it was either Russia or China. Russia, China. No one thought about North Korea. But now you have this article from the Daily Caller hyping up North Korea as though they were the imminent threat. And we haven't seen that kind of North Korea hype since, like, 2014. Like, I talked about the hype starting in North Korea a few weeks ago. It ain't the same, man. It ain't the same. Back in my day, you know, we'd have those military comparison videos for World War III, and they'd show you all the troops and the tanks and of all the different countries. And it was, and back then, the North Korea hype, it was real. It was real. Not in a sense that North Korea was going to attack us, but there was a real effort to play this country up. Like, North Korea got, how the kids say, rizzed up by the propaganda press. Like, the fourth largest army. There was even, like, a movie. It was Red Dawn. It was a remake of the original, but it was Red Dawn. And it was the North Koreans invading us instead of, like, the Soviets. So, I did like that movie, though. It was entertaining to me. But, yeah. Compare that to now, where they have to remind us that North Korea is this big, important threat that we need to worry about. Because this article would not leave North Korea alone. Like, it would talk about China a little bit, and then it would go, North Korea is firing missiles, and North Korea could invade the South at any moment. The United States could wake up at war with North Korea. And it's like, okay. And then it's like, oh, if China invades Taiwan, that means North Korea is going to invade South Korea. Because, like, up till now, when discussions about a China-Taiwan war was had between various think tanks and various panels of experts and various little mini-docs that they post on to the YouTube channels, it was purely China-Taiwan, U.S. gets drawn in. That was the dynamic. China, Taiwan, U.S. gets drawn in. Now, they found a way to make North Korea relevant again. Oh, if China invades Taiwan, that means North Korea invades South Korea because North Korea and China are allies. South Korea and the U.S. are allies, so if China's at war with the U.S., well, it makes sense for allies to go to war with the allies of other enemies. So, I guess that's the angle that they've done here. But I just can't help but notice that major difference that time has made. But anyway, they talked about North Korea being provocative and China being provocative. But North Korea, it was all about North Korea and the threat that they posed to the South. Now, conveniently, or at the very least, not conveniently, but strangely, they didn't bring up how North Korea could, like, flatten Seoul, the capital city of South Korea. They couldn't, like, flatten the city with all their artillery, which they have on the border, and Seoul is really close to the border. Now, that's the stuff that I used to hear back in the day, at the height of the North Korea hype. They didn't bring that up. They use China to give relevance to North Korea, and then played up North Korea. So, are we gonna see the North Korea-South Korea conflict break out? Is this what they're trying to do now? Because I don't see any other reason you could go so hard on North Korea when you're supposedly talking about tensions between the U.S. and China. So that's a question I have now. If they've found another war that they want to drum up to try to distract Americans from the inevitable defeat that the Ukrainians are going to suffer to Russia. Oh, look at Taiwan. Oh, look at South Korea. Look at the DMZ. Things are heating up on the DMZ. Don't you care about the DMZ? At this point, they may as well go in for a penny, in for a pound, and start playing up the Iran angle as well. Oh, look at the tensions between Israel and Iran. The United States needs to be ready and prepared for the prospect of a war with Iran, a ground war in the Middle East with Iran. At this point, they may as well just go all in. If they're gonna scrape the bottom of the barrel and bring North Korea back into the picture, they may as well. Why not ISIS? Heck, the Taliban's back in charge in Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate is strong and thriving. They have all those weapons we left behind for them. What is it? The fourth largest fleet of attack helicopters in the world. They're a bigger danger today than they were supposedly back then when we invaded them the first time. They may as well, you know, if they're gonna bring North Korea out of retirement, then they may as well. But nevertheless, the article went on to cover the increasing military infrastructure that the U.S. is setting up in Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Taiwan, and it uses China and South Korea, China and North Korea, not South Korea. It uses those two as the sort of justification for the U.S. doing this, and it has to, like, prime you by bringing up all those things first before talking about the U.S. building up military infrastructure in all these countries to make it look like we're responding to them when truthfully it's the other way around, and they don't want us there, but we've chosen to stay. But that's how it was framed, and we're setting up in Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Taiwan. So this is the theater. And there was a quote from Lieutenant General James Bierman. He's the commanding officer of the U.S. Marine Corps in Japan, and he called it setting the theater, and that's why labeled this segment setting the theater, because that's what they're doing. They're setting up, they're pre-positioning equipment, they're pre-positioning supply lines and pre-positioning bases of operation in preparation for a future conflict. That's what the article said. Where's that conflict going to be had? Is it going to be China? Well, if you're going to involve the Philippines, then it's obviously going to be China. Otherwise, the Philippines wouldn't need to be involved if it was just North Korea. So, just by process of elimination, we can see that the conflict they're talking about is with China. And they have used China as a means of bringing North Korea back into relevancy. Because, oh, if China invades Taiwan, North Korea is going to invade the South Korea. So therefore, it's a good thing that we're pre-positioning equipment, supply lines, and bases of operations so that when we go to war, they too are treating this as an inevitable thing, so that when we go to war, we'll have all these things set up for us already, and we can just get right to fighting and killing those Chinese, right to fighting and killing those North Koreans, and sacrificing the lives of all these allies of ours in the process. And that's what they want us to go along with. This is blatant manufacture of consent. Whether or not it will succeed in getting that consent is a different question. Although, there are parts of the population that are more willing to go along with this than the rest. Namely, the Republicans will be more than happy to go along with some war with China over Taiwan. Why they would do that, I don't know. Why they've latched on so heavily to this idea, I couldn't tell you. Because it's certainly not an America First position to go fight and die for someone else's country. That's very much not an America First position. So I don't know. I really couldn't tell you. And for the same reason I couldn't tell you why so many people, primarily Democrats, but many people, latched on to Ukraine as hard as they did. Some people still justify giving all the billions we've given to Ukraine and still want us to give more. So I couldn't say. But this is what they're doing. They're trying to manufacture consent for this war. And I disagree that we should go there. Now, if you're a long time or even a medium time listener of this podcast, you know perfectly well, I don't think we need to be anywhere near this place, let alone Taiwan Island. South Korea is one thing. Taiwan Island is a losing war. I mean, heck, South Korea was almost a losing war. We almost lost in South Korea. Like, it got bad. We were, one day, the South Koreans got chased all the way back to, like, the southwest corner of their country. We showed up, we pushed the North Koreans back. We landed at Incheon, and all of a sudden, the North Koreans, their entire lines fell apart because they had to defend against that, and we pushed them all the way back across the 39th parallel, and we were pushing up, and then the Chinese got involved with, like, 400,000 men. Then they pushed us back. We almost went right back to where we started, but then we got our act together, pushed them back, and then the front stabilized along the borders you see the two having today. Which ironically ended up with North Korea getting minimal territorial gains, but gains nonetheless. So, this is another losing war that they're trying to get us involved in. I'm almost surprised at how many losing wars and losing bets that they keep placing. It's the exact opposite of the Iranians. The Iranians at least know how to bet on the winner. At least they know how to do that. We're betting on every loser we can get our hands on. South Korea might be able to win a war against the North, but they can't win a war against China. And they certainly can't win a war against China and North Korea, even with our help. Because we can't win a war against China in the area around China. Now, if we were just duking it out in the middle of the desert in the Middle East, maybe we could beat them, right? I'd say we'd have a clear and obvious advantage in that type of an environment. But if we're talking about a maritime conflict, which is what it would primarily be, because we'd have to get there by air and by sea, because there's no land connection for us to get to South Korea, for us to get to Taiwan. That would mean sailing ships and flying planes well into the range of Chinese anti-ship missiles and their air defenses, and well into the range of Chinese ballistic missiles. Those ballistic missiles can hit Taiwan. Those missiles can hit South Korea. And quite frankly, well into the range of the Chinese Air Force. The entirety of it. The Chinese could put their entire Air Force up and reach South Korea, anywhere in South Korea. They could reach anywhere in Taiwan. We can only send up bits and pieces of our Air Force because they have to be put on carriers. Unless we want to base them in Japan, because if we base them in South Korea, they're going to get blown up. If we base them in Taiwan, they're definitely going to get blown up. We could base them in the Philippines. And I think that's why we're trying so desperately to involve Japan and the Philippines, to give us some kind of strategic depth. Because Guam, Guam is small. And the next island, Guam is small and it's far. So it's not exactly the best if you're trying to get involved. If you're trying to get involved. But like, it's an attempt at trying to get some strategic depth in an area where we don't have any strategic depth at all. And the Chinese can dominate the airspace. They can dominate the waves. Both in the conventional sense with ships and planes, and in the more kind of non-conventional sense, in that they can deny us supremacy with their anti-ship missiles. They can deny us air supremacy with their air defense missiles. So, this is a losing conflict, whether it's South Korea or Taiwan, let alone the two of them together, and I guess they're trying to lump the two of them in together to try to reinvigorate fear over Taiwan falling. So, if China invades Taiwan, it's not just going to be a war over Taiwan, it's going to be a war between North Korea and South Korea. And that's really what they're trying to push here. So they're trying to make a war that already is not one we need to be getting involved in. They're trying to make it appear even bigger to drum up support in America for getting involved. Support that we'll regret after the fact, but by that point it's too late. So I don't see how I don't want us to be over there. But I don't see how we avoid going over there when no one on this side of the Pacific wants to stay on our side of the Pacific. And we're pre-positioning equipment, supply lines, and bases. That's the way it is. It doesn't need to be that way, but that's what's happening. And we're even talking about increasing our nuclear options in South Korea. Japan is continuing its recent trend of increasing its military budget. And then there's the 18,000 U.S. Marines that are going to be stationed in Okinawa to operate missiles that have the range to hit mainland China. So, we're doing everything in our power to guarantee that Japan gets dragged into this war just by the presence of our troops and our military assets. And I imagine something similar will happen with the Philippines, just in a naval sense rather than a Marines and an Air Force sense. But that's what they're trying to do. So the war, they're priming, they're what do they say, they're what they call it? They call it, they're setting the theater in East Asia. And what a show it's going to be. And I have a feeling it'll be one that we'll never be able to forget. And one that we wish we could. Because we're going to lose that war. We're going to be the guy that dies at the end of that movie. Or at the very least, the guy that gets shot and has to limp away. And the other guy dies, that guy being Taiwan. And maybe South Korea, if this really plays out this way. I don't want it to be that way. But that's what it looks like we're dealing with. And there's a lot of things I didn't want to be this way. No, for starters, we're an interventionist country. And I'm an isolationist, but hey. But I've been thinking about this. I've been thinking about this over the last week. Thinking about the actions we've taken over the course of the Russo-Ukrainian War. And that's the focus of my thoughts here. The results that said actions have earned us, you know, $125 billion down the drain. A third of our HIMARS ammunition gone. Probably more by now. And a whole year of potential diplomacy wasted. Blunders after blunder. Blunders doesn't quite cut it, but I'll say blunders. These blunders, which will likely result in the death of an entire country, a whole nation wiped off the map because of our inability to so much as speak to the Russians in anything that wasn't disingenuous. I mean, we're getting confirmation now out of the leaders that were in charge of Europe, primarily from Merkel and the leaders of France, I believe, François Hollande, that the Minsk agreements were never that they never had any intention of bringing about the Minsk agreements as was agreed to. Now, we can visibly observe that they had no intention of doing that, which was evident by the fact that nothing was done to enforce it from our side onto the Ukrainians. We never put any kind of pressure to get the Ukrainians to abide by what they agreed to. We never did that. So that much was observable, but hearing them sort of come out and start saying it now is the real kicker. And which goes back to the point that I make as to whenever I talk about the war and how I don't believe that there's going to be a Ukraine when the war is over. Russia cannot trust Ukraine. They can't trust us either. But you had this treaty, this agreement that they had agreed to, the Minsk agreements, the Minsk Accords. And for 8 years, Russia was the only one living up to their side of the deal. Ukraine never stopped shelling the civilians. They never plotted out a course for autonomy for the Donbass within Ukraine. They never did anything that they said they would do. They didn't live up to it, and nobody in Europe, nobody in America, even made the attempt to force them to that. So now that we're getting, and just off that alone, the Russians can't trust Ukraine to honor any sort of treaty that they would sign with Russia. Like, if Russia did leave Ukraine, a piece of Ukraine, alive, what reason would Russia have to trust that the Ukrainians would honor or abide by any treaty that they signed with Russia? Like, say, don't join NATO, don't join the EU. No, 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 no. Like, if they did that, what reason would Russia have to believe that the Ukrainians, after having been beaten in a war by Russia, after having reneged on every other agreement that they had together, what reason would Russia have to believe that the Ukrainians would abide by that? They have no reason. And now when we're hearing that the former leaders of Germany and France, and I think, you know, Germany and France, now that we're hearing that they had no intention of even trying with the Minsk Accords, Russia has negative reasons to trust anybody in Europe for anything that they say. Let alone the Ukrainians, because the Ukrainians were in on it from the beginning. They have zero reason to trust us. They have negative reasons to trust us. And that's going to stick around for a while. And the more that these happenstances come about, and we learn about these things, and the more that I think about this war and how it's gone and the things that we could have done, I just can't help but realize all the opportunities we've missed. All the opportunities. A whole year of potential diplomacy wasted. And I mean that. What? Just look at Turkey. Look at India. Turkey and India are case studies in how we could have played the war to our advantage. Even in the short term. Because Turkey was making gains right off the bat. They de facto nationalized the straits. And Ukrainian grain shipments, both on Ukrainian ships and Russian ships, had to stop in Turkish ports before going through the straits. They had de facto nationalized the Bosphorus. They nationalized the Bosphorus Straits. And no one noticed. No one noticed. In fact, they were encouraged. They used the situation as leverage to do what they wanted to do with their own territory. And no one complained. No one said, hey, you can't do that. No one said this is a violation of your treaties. No, this is a violation of international law. No one had anything to say. Turkey gave us Turkey throughout this entire war has given us a masterclass in how we could have been using the war to further our own real interests, not the fake interests about, oh, we have to be in Ukraine, we have to keep Russia at bay, we have to go fight Putin, and we have to overthrow Putin. No, those are fake. Those are ambitions, not interests. Turkey has shown us just some of the ways that countries could have used the war to further their national interests. And I just can't help but feel like we've wasted so much time. Like, and Ukraine's going to die because of it. But it got me thinking how we could have conducted ourselves throughout this whole ordeal. The things we could have done differently, the business opportunities we could have taken, how many lives, both Ukrainian and Russian, let alone the third parties in Africa and the Middle East who are going to starve.
How many lives could we have saved?
How many lives? And that's going to be a real question when the final death tally comes in. But here's the scenario. War breaks out. First and foremost. And this is how we could have done things a little differently. Just to give you an idea of some of the opportunities I'm feeling that we missed. War breaks out. Russia, Ukraine. First and foremost, we could have used the war as an opportunity for de-escalation with Russia. And I've said this a multitude of times. But and how could we have done that? For those of you who missed those episodes. We could have did it by, number one, not overtly aligning ourselves with Russia's enemy, Ukraine. And that doesn't mean we needed to overtly back Russia on this either. We could have just stayed out, like China, like India, and like, well, just about every country that wasn't Europe or the Anglosphere, or us. We could have stayed out. Turkey was able to stay out, and they're a member of NATO. Belarus was able to stay out, and they have a border with both of the countries involved. We could have stayed out. You know, that's the first thing we could have done. And that alone would have gone a long ways towards showing Russia that we mean no harm. Showing them, as opposed to telling them that we come in peace, and then selling weapons to countries on their doorstep, and then trying to add those countries to our military alliance, like we did with Georgia before they got invaded, like we did with Ukraine before they got invaded, and like we did with Sweden and Finland after Ukraine got invaded. Like, that first step would have gone a long way. Number two, we could have de-escalated with Russia by not trying to cancel Russia's entire economy along with their currency, with 500,000 sanctions, kicking them off of the SWIFT system, and freezing their assets that they held in dollars. We could have not done that. Although, quite frankly, it's working out in Russia's favor. They're learning just how strong their economy was. They don't need us. We think we're being told Russia's economy is in tatters. Russia's economy is thriving. And we threw everything we had at them. They're winning the war while under economic siege. We didn't need to do that. We chose to. And then there's number three. We could have de-escalated with Russia by cutting deals with them. But what kind of deals could we have cut? If the Europeans sanctioned Russia, even on their own accord, then we, like India and China, could have been purchasing Russian oil and then reselling it to the Europeans. We could have did that. If India, a country with no oil, could do that, if China, a country with minimal oil reserves, could do that, then certainly we would have the capacity to do that. I mean, shoot, we have our own oil that we could have did that with. If we were energy independent, mind the way. But let's pretend that we're not energy independent. Okay, we could still have done that. That's still something we could have done. If we're being completely honest about the Biden administration and the policies that they have, well, if we're being honest, then everything I'm saying would never have happened anyway. But if the scenario that we were in prior to the war breaking out is the one that we had to operate in under the war, sure. We could still be purchasing Russian oil, at the very least, to keep gas prices down here in the United States. And we could have bought surplus oil to resell to the Europeans and make some profits back and cover some of our losses from buying Russian oil to fill the gap. The Biden administration, even after killing our energy independence, could have done that. And we'd probably be applauding them for some brilliant diplomacy. They could have did that. But we also could have gotten agreements on the demilitarization of the Arctic, something that Russia was already in favor of and would be even more likely to agree to while at war. Those are just some basic ideas we could have done, some basic deals we could have done. But there's one opportunity I can't get off my mind. I call it the Grand Siberian Pipeline, and I believe I spoke about it in my second anniversary episode. And it's a pipeline, or a series of pipelines, however it would work out, that would run from the continental U.S. up through Alaska, across the Bering Straits into Russia, then down through Siberia into China, getting us a direct line into the massive energy markets of the East. Because the pipeline once you get into Russia, it can go farther. It can go way farther. You could run it down through China into Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand. You could run it from Siberia into Japan via the Sakhalin Islands. You could run it further west within Russia and then down through the Central Asian states into either Iran or Pakistan or even Afghanistan or eventually into India. And this would be a colossal undertaking, mind you, but it would have colossal rewards. We'd be able to tap the vast energy markets of the East, a market measured in billions of people. China and India together, that's 3 billion alone. But that could only be made possible through cooperation with Russia. Cooperation that we could have used the war as leverage to get. Instead of betting the family farm on Ukraine. Heck, if we really pushed it, we could have had a pipeline running all the way to Europe from across Russia, going the long way. Instead of going across the Atlantic, we could have had a pipeline going up through Siberia, through Russia, and then through either the Black Sea or the Baltic Sea, going bam, now it's into Europe. And then we'd have a direct line into Europe going through Russia. If we pushed it, we could run it through Turkey. And then Turkey would be a gas hub for our gas, too. And we wouldn't be fretting about, oh, Turkey, they're abandoning the West. They're becoming a gas hub for Russian gas. Oh, look at that. We can use Turkey as a gas hub for our gas, too. Possibilities that could have been open. Now, granted, we'd essentially be asking the Russians to help us, to help put us into direct competition with them in just about every market that they have access to. But they'd get transit fees. So there's the bribe. And if Canada wants in, then we can run it through Canada. And then through Alaska. And we can just both agree to not charge transit fees. Because even if we go through Canada, whatever gas they have coming out of Canada would then have to go back through Alaska. Not, and we could charge fees, or we could both agree not to do that. They could have in, or they could have out. Well, if they'd want out, we can just run the pipeline around them via the water. Thanks to the way that Alaska is shaped, there's a piece of it that juts out to the southeast. We wouldn't have to go far to go from Seattle to Alaska. And we could have did that. We could have did that. And something like that would be huge. It would have to be designed, built, maintained. Then we'd have to produce the oil and the natural gas running through those pipelines, which means we'd have to produce it in large quantities. That amount of energy production would, one, make the United States energy independent all by itself. Two, would make energy cheap here in the United States, and gas, not just natural gas, but at the pump, gasoline. It'd make everything cheap here in the United States, and we would by focusing the minds of both Russians and Americans on a common, mutually beneficial goal, you would create de-escalation through partnership on this grand project. And then, as a side bonus, you know, I'm always America first, but as a side bonus, literal billions of people would benefit from having cheap energy. If you have America and Russia teaming up to provide energy. Now, we'd be selling you the energy, but hey, that's energy you didn't have before. It would be an objective benefit to the world by doing that. And if we're running the pipeline to China, that's de-escalation with China as well. Like, massive opportunity. Massive opportunity. Wasted. And if we did that, we would have benefited greatly from Russia's inevitable victory in this war. Instead of betting the family farm on Ukraine and emptying out our coffers. Emptying out our arsenals, just for them to lose anyway. There would be no talk of nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia, because we'd be too busy building pipelines to even think about that. Now, there's something to think about. There is definitely something to think about. I just wanted to dump that onto you guys. Maybe you think I'm crazy, but that's what's been on my mind. All the missed opportunities, with that being just some of them. I'm sure more will pop up as time goes on. If only we could have taken them. But that, my lovely listeners, is all I've got for you today. I do hope you've enjoyed today's broadcast on my geopolitical podcast. The world is changing. Lots of opportunities to be had. Some countries will take them, like Turkey, like India. Others won't, like, unfortunately, Europe and the United States. But no matter what happens, no matter how that world changes, we will have fun watching it together. Now, I've been your host, Hyshawn Wade, and you've been listening to This Week in Geopolitics. So till we meet again next Monday, Servus.